All right. Okay, so today we are going to have a discussion on DMS, and I'm going to start it out by showing some experimental data and giving at least some of my viewpoints and hopefully some of the other viewpoints. We had a talk in the conference about it, so if you heard it, then you have some background. But I will kind of assume that you didn't hear the talk. So the connection to this our workshop is not that much whether these DMS materials, diluted magnetic semiconductor materials, can be used for technology in spintronics or not. Connection is that what kind of exotic, or if not exotic, at least interesting phases, not quite expected phases, we can expect in this material, mostly from the disorder between interplay between disorder and magnetism, but perhaps from other richness in the Hamiltonian. Yes, I could, but that's a different talk. So let's talk about it. Technological applications basically are, so the reason there is so much interest in DMS, in fact, this is a big place for DMS. This place has more money than any other place. Maybe all the other places combined, okay? It's a historical accident. Giant magnet resistance was discovered by physicists in 1988, where they found that certain materials, magnetic materials, the resistance changes by some finite percentage when two layers have their magnetic moments aligned parallel or anti-parallel. Okay, parallel is lower resistance, anti-parallel is higher resistance. And it was actually PRL, very basic research, I believe in 1987 from Albert Fert's group in France, and also a German group in Jülich, at 1 Kelvin or below 1 Kelvin. And this thing eventually got converted into technology within 5 years. It's the fastest conversion from PRL to a real technology. And this is now the, this is one of the things that made laptops this small. It's a GMR read head. It's a very small read head. It just reads the resistance change. And it's not a huge industry, but $10 to $20 billion industry. And so this is passive use of the total, total information technology is $1 trillion. So more than $1 trillion. And so this is passive use of spin, because magnetism is already there. This is, cobalt and nickel, things like that. So magnetism is already there. All you're doing is switching the, domain, which way they are, by applying magnetic field. So the idea came up that if we could now control spin actively, then maybe we can do many even more exciting things, unknown things, disruptive technology and so on. But to tell you the truth, other than completely... Well, this is, you will see what it is, because in metals, you cannot control anything because you cannot apply. You know why transistors are not made of metals, but are semiconductors, right? All of you know. So metals have many more electrons than semiconductors. Why is it that one had to wait for semiconductors? The reason is very simple. It has too many electrons. You cannot really do anything from outside. Outside application electric field will not modulate properties of metals at all, okay? Which is where semiconductors come in. So if you can somehow do the same thing with spin as what you do in semiconductors with charge, meaning modulate their properties by applying electric field, magnetic field, light from outside, which you simply cannot do in metals. Then the idea was that you are controlled. So active use of spin, that's what is meant by active. So, and then more or less at the same time, about 5-6 years ago, well, actually 7 years ago, a true magnetic semiconductor was invented, this gallium manganese arsenide. So these two things kind of came together. The GMR became actual technology, and magnetic semiconductors were invented or discovered. So people thought, well, if we could now control spin because it's a semiconductor, maybe we can do many more things. It has still remained at that stage. Maybe we can do many more things. Lots of people have proposed many more things, but none of them has actually come to pass. And so it's not clear what new thing it can do because materials aren't very good, but it's still an exciting possibility. Okay. I think the technological talks on it, a lot of fluff without really much concrete things, because technology, unless you actually do something, it's all words. Okay, so the thing that I want to point out is that interplay between disorder and magnetism, I think, is an important angle in these systems, which could lead to some new physics. And this is an old subject, right, in physics, interplay of magnetism and disorder. What is special about these materials? And that's what I'll try to point out, and then others will say things. There are other experts.
But the summary is that we shouldn't start investing in this yet.
No, we have already invested many, many millions of dollars, because you have to invest. You have to invest because so that the basic research gets to a point. Much of the investment has been on these materials, if you can raise TC to room temperature. And the other kind of investment has been what kind of devices you can make in the laboratory. So what has not happened yet?
An example of something which we would actually do with active control of spin?
You can make a spin transistor. Now the problem is then you're going to ask me, what good is that?
Well, yeah.
Okay, what good is that? And that's a very fair question. It creates lots of spins, but you know, that's a tautology. That's a tautology, right?
Is it supposed to be a processor or a memory or a...
Oh, I can tell you the ultimate dream. Where? I mean, I don't want to open my ultimate dream thing. Okay, so I should tell you that. Okay, I should tell you that. Okay. So what is now? That's a very serious question, and there is an answer. So right now, our technology, electronic technology, is based on three different circles. I have these three big circles. One is electronics. Transistor, basically, okay, MOS or p-n junction. The other is magnetic storage, okay, that includes memory also. Storage and memory are not distinguished for this part. Some of the storage is done by semiconductor MOS, and the other is optoelectronics, or use light. These are really totally three different things, although optoelectronics and transistors have come together in many cases, gallium arsenide. And why does it take so long to boot up your computer? Because the magnetic storage and the processing, your Pentium chip and your disks are totally different things. They have nothing to do with each other. Made by different companies, you know, they don't even talk to each other. Suppose you could do on the same chip storage and processing. Clearly, there'll be new usage. So that's one thing that's driving this. This was a dream that has been around for a very long time. Yeah, what? Well, that's true too. And you, at least you didn't ask my question. Bart Halper didn't ask. He said, why do you want to boot up your computer faster? And he was clearly intrigued, and he would not let me go. Okay, continue. I said, Bart, you have a point. I don't know why. This is what people say, so this is what I'm saying. Okay. And it's a very good question, but you know, that's just my example.
McKinsey's probably studying how many billions of dollars are lost from the 2 minutes every
right. No, I think that, you know, I can imagine, look, this is not something people in this room or physicists are going to figure out.
Why do you want to get rid of punch cards?
Yeah. I can imagine that if you can do processing and storage on the same chip, even new usage will emerge. Okay, what they are is not for us to figure out, okay? I mean, as Carver Mead said, what would happen is that somebody would figure out a way of making money out of this. Once that happens, it becomes a technology. I have not figured out a way to make money out of this, is all I can tell you, okay? What?
I would say that's a strong statement.
That is a strong statement.
You have not.
I have not. I'm funded, but this is a little money, you know. $500,000 here, $500,000. $500,000 here, $500,000 there. We are talking about real money, you know. Okay.
But when you say active control, you do mean something.
Yeah. You'll see what I mean. Okay, so these materials, and I'm going to explain the materials in some details, gallium manganese arsenide is the canonical example, the best example, have many different types of disorder. Okay, arises from random positions of manganese, which is the magnetic dopant here. And these are semiconductors. They're all kinds of disorder and defects. They're coins, but not completely coins. You can anneal them and change them around. They're anti-sites, interstitials, this clustering, there's charge impurities. And they're all important in a number of different ways. So, you know, so the problem may be too rich. Okay, but some aspects are coming out, and I think in the context of our program here, this is a very important subject, you know, but in the context of our program, this discussion of disorder and magnetism may be quite appropriate. Now, there are also several magnetic interactions in this system. You have a basic ferromagnetic interaction between the manganese moments, which is actually carrier-mediated, and I'll explain what I mean by that. It's an indirect exchange. You can think of it as RKKY, if not quite RKKY. The manganese polarizes the carriers, and that information is conveyed through the carrier system to the next manganese, which is reasonably far away. So that's that exchange interaction is ferromagnetic between the manganese ions, independent of whether the interaction, local interaction between manganese and the carrier is ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic. But there's also a direct super exchange interaction between two manganese atoms, two manganese moments, and that's always antiferromagnetic. Now, manganese is fairly dilute, and this antiferromagnetic interaction is typically very short range, so normally they don't play a role. In fact, Grower is trying to reduce this antiferromagnetic interaction because the goal here is to make TC high. But to do physics, I have been telling people that you really want to make this antiferromagnetic interaction stronger. Put the manganese nearby, have this ferromagnetic antiferromagnetic interaction compete, and let's see what comes out. You heard about, you know, the talk was basically a lot on spin orbit coupling.
The carrier mediated, doesn't have to be ferromagnetic.
No, it doesn't have to be. But in this particular case, it seems it doesn't have to be. But in this particular case, it seems that the way it's going, it's more or less always ferromagnetic in this class of materials. But I do agree with you. It doesn't have to be. You can have.
It's very dilute, right?
It's very dilute. Yeah. So, yeah. I'll come to that. I know what you're saying.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure,
yeah. Yeah. In fact, that will play a role. I mean, Leon is absolutely correct. And some of the phases we are proposing, that physics comes in when KF is sum
that's
of
why I meant
large.
It,
I yeah, absolutely. No, no. I mean, I'll come to that. Yeah.
So Manganese will get this because
yeah,
as well.
Right. And so spin orbit induced. Yeah. This is our PRL that the referee said are very, very interesting but speculative. So spin orbit induced frustration. We heard a lot about it in the talk we had, and I know Greg Fitt has done a lot of work. I will really not say much about it. People from the audience should say much about it. Spin orbit interaction is strong because all this action is in the valence band, and you know the canonical theory here has been really an incredibly simple-minded theory of just a mean field theory, something that Weiss could have done in 1905. Of mean field in two sense, both thermal mean field, you ignore all thermal fluctuations, which may be okay, and also spatial mean field. That means you make a virtual crystal approximation, forget the lattice structure, you assume a jelly of you know manganese, some effective manganese, and that's the paradigm. So that's why theorists should think about it, because you know your computation is doing very weak things, this kind of thing. Okay. Okay. So So the standard talk that I give, I mean, that's the only transparency I made for this discussion. So the standard talk I give is how to make semiconductors ferromagnetic. So let me also then, I mean, basically what you have to do is dope semiconductor magnetic impurities, okay? That's what dilated magnetic semiconductors are. Some examples, gallium manganese arsenide, indium manganese arsenide, germanium manganese, zinc, chromium, telluride. This is a very recent material. It was in a PRL last year. Gallium manganese nitride, and there are other materials like oxide materials, magnetic oxide, cobalt titanium oxide, cobalt zinc oxide. And you know, we want to know what the mechanisms are, what the models are, and we want to discuss affective disorder. And the big thing in the subject, and I'm not going to discuss this in great details, is how to enhance critical temperature. No, I'll come to that. That's the next point. No, that's the next one. They can be metals or insulators. They can be conducting or localized. Yes. Yeah.
Let's.
Yeah, so I'll come to that. I'll come to that. This is introduction. Yeah, just wait for a minute. Right. So that's one, or maybe by changing other parameters, right? Carrier density itself. You know, you can change, you can enhance coupling by going from one material to another because the same material is fixed. So that's one goal, okay? And many of these are claimed, it's very much like high TC. Every other week, it has slowed down a little bit. There is a claim for a room temperature TC. But one has to be careful, often they're just precipitates. So for example, manganese arsenide itself is a very nice ferromagnet with a different structure, lattice structure than gallium manganese arsenide, gallium arsenide. Manganese nitride is a very good ferromagnet also, insulating ferromagnets. So when people claim it to be room temperature, first question you have to ask, is it an intrinsic new material or is it just precipitate? It's very difficult to make these things. Manganese doesn't want to dissolve in gallium arsenide. So when you make it, that's why it took so long. These ideas go back 30 years. So when you put manganese and gallium arsenide, it precipitates and phase separates. You have manganese arsenide and gallium arsenide. So what this Hideo Ono, you know, it was by 10 years of just sheer hard work, he managed to make a uniform material. So the questions that are coming up now, let's deal with some of them.
Can you say, talk about how much activity there is amongst these different materials? I mean, I would guess it's 95% gallium arsenide.
Okay, so let me tell you the activities. Very good question. So this is, you know, this is very approximate. I would say about 80% gallium manganese arsenide, 10% or maybe 15% all the other arsenide materials. Okay, so all the 3-5 materials. Yeah. That would be indium manganese arsenide, gallium manganese nitride, and gallium manganese antimonide. That's it. Nothing else is being studied. So that's maybe, let's say that's about 15%. The other 5% is germanium manganese. And maybe that's 1%. And the other 4% is magnetic oxides. And the activity magnetic oxide is going up now. So that's titanium oxide doped with cobalt. Yeah. Hafnium oxide doped with cobalt. Tin oxide doped with cobalt. I like these materials because I have many experimental papers in that subject. The reason is I told our group at Maryland who are doing high TC materials and CMR materials. I told them they're wasting their time. They will never lift any technology. They should take titanium oxide and dope it with cobalt. And they stopped all their work, did it, and you know, within a week they saw ferromagnetism. And they think I'm some kind of god. They don't know that somebody else already saw it before. That's the reason I told them. And so these materials are coming up because many of them are transparent materials. Okay.
Another question. Do people try to, let's say, to do two kinds of doping?
Yes, okay, that's, yeah. Yeah, so you're asking all these questions. You guys are very smart, so come later. So why didn't this thing happen before? Because before people could not find material, you know, 2-6 materials, cadmium, manganese, telluride. Enormous amount of work was done on this kind of material, zinc, manganese, selenide, in the 80s. They never led to anything. They were all like bad spin glasses. Finally, after a lot of work, they produced a TC, ferromagnetic TC of 1 Kelvin, and then the subject disappeared. The reason there was that manganese is not a dopant in 2,6 material. When you look at manganese as valence, but manganese is a dopant in 3,5 materials. So there, the carriers have to be induced by something else. So they co-doped with something else. And when you do that, you have enormous amount of scattering. And you have enormous amount of scattering, as you see, material becomes insulating and TC is very low. And all these things are still open issues, by the way.
Same will work for gallium manganese arsenide if you dope something from manganese.
People have claimed, there are claims, which we recently have a paper where there is some support, and Alan McDonald some support, that if you take gallium manganese arsenide, and there are carriers coming from manganese itself, but you co-dope it, in this particular case, from bicarbon, this is a group in Florida, a very good group actually, Art Hibbert is one of the co-authors, then they claim that TC goes all the way up to 200 Kelvin. I myself, and I'm, you know, if you're interested, I can show you those results. I don't want to talk about my work that much. We have a prediction that doing nothing in gallium manganese arsenide is going to bring up to 300 Kelvin, because when you keep on increasing carrier density, a stage comes, because of the question Chetan and Leon were asking or commenting on, that when you make the carrier density very high, eventually you get into the RKKY oscillations, and you get, you know, your regular Frasser spin glass, which is very well known among physicists, but not that well known among semiconductor people. Okay, so these are the questions we want to ask, and which are quite appropriate within this, you know, this group of people.
Sorry, sir. So one thing you said that was a problem is that you're precipitating out basically manganese nitride. How are they characterizing that?
Right. So yeah. So you are asking hard questions. So in fact, I myself do not believe that a case for an intrinsic new material has been made in any of these systems, with the exception of gallium manganese arsenide and maybe indium manganese arsenide. Okay, so this is a very good question that you and I would not be able to settle. There's a whole kind of characterization that they do. Okay, I mean, we can discuss this separately. It's not really appropriate here. And still questions remain. It's not so easy, because TEM, you may not see anything. See, one very bad sign, which happens often, is that you happen to get a TC which is very high, but within a few kelvins of the natural TC of that precipitated material. That happens quite often. The first report on titanium cobalt oxide, TC was 1300 Kelvin, which just conveniently happens to be cobalt TC, okay? Whenever that happens, you should be very, very suspicious, okay? So the question you are asking, how do you know it's intrinsic? There are three specific tests that people propose, but I'm not sure even those three will convincingly show. Carriers must participate somehow, come to. Carriers must participate in the ferromagnetism somehow. So you gotta see anomalous Hall effect in all its glory, so then you know carriers are doing something. Second, you have to be able to change TC, you have to be able to modulate TC by changing the carrier density, basic semiconductor physics, and there have been several Nature and Science, then by applying electric field from outside, changing the electron density or carrier density, you can change TC. And the third one is something called MCD, chromatism, basically. Okay, so you apply light, okay? So dichroism effect should be seen. That, again, is a carrier effect. But, you know, it's possible that not all three can be seen even in an intrinsic materials. But these are the experiments that one has to do. So this is a hard question. This is a very hard question, okay? And I would be surprised if in terms of it's all precipitated. Yeah.
But I just wanted to add one thing to what you said. I mean, there is, a very clear test of whether the material is intrinsically ferromagnetic or not. And these are the ferromagnetic resonance experiments, where you can actually see like spin wave energies across a thin sample and see that the sample is uniformly, well, the magnetization is throughout the sample. It may not be uniform, there may be boundary effects, but you can at least see that the entire sample is magnetic and there's not just clusters in there. So these FMR measurements, many of them...
Because the line broadening is not huge, that's how? Or?
The line, you can also look at the spectrum and you can estimate what would you expect based on...
Oh, so you need some theory there, though.
Yeah, so you need some theory okay. for what magnetic material would be, but you can fit the FMR spectrum quite
yeah.
well.
This one I would not put at the same footing as the first three, because first three are qualitative tests. Because carriers are directly, this will be a test of how uniform the system is. Hey, maybe it's a uniform precipitate. It's a thin film. I'm saying if I say that, you would not have an argument against that. I'd have said maybe it's all kind of manganese arsenide and there are some holes, gallium arsenide sitting there.
Yeah, I mean, okay. But I think it will certainly distinguish between clusters.
Yeah, it will. I agree.
One more question about the growth of these things. I mean, the gallium manganese arsenide is some highly non-equilibrium layer by layer growth. Are any of them just
No. They're all MBE growth, and they're very bad MBE growth. They are what is called low temperature MBE growth, which if you go to Laurent Pfeiffer and ask him to do, he'll laugh you off. In fact, he would not even let you talk to him, because these are basically growth at slightly above room temperature, you know, so 400 Kelvin. Laurent Pfeiffer samples are grown at 800 Kelvin. So the reason you do it very low temperature, because you want to create metastable structures. These are very metastable structures. When you look at the chemistry, just you take tick chemistry of these materials, gallium arsenide and manganese arsenide should stay separate. And so give you an idea, you know about quantum Hall effect. So the highest mobilities that people can produce in gallium arsenide by doing very good MB growth is like 25 million, just to give some number in units, never mind the unit, centimeter square per volt second. The highest mobility you can get in these samples is 50. Not 50,000, not certainly 50 billion, just 50, okay? So this gives you an idea about what you're talking about. This is in the best metallic samples, okay? That's called the best metallic sample. So these systems are, and if you just do a calculation of resistivity based on spin scattering, which you have recently done, you haven't published it, you find a number which is, you know, many thousands. So there is a lot of disorder here, which have nothing to do with just spin disorder scattering. Okay, they're just charge defects, impurities, you know, whatnot, complete mess. But it turns out for technological applications, high mobility is not an issue. You know, I mean, to give you an idea, silicon mobility in your Pentium processor is of the order of a couple of hundred. So it's not, you know, because they just make things very small. So that by itself is not going to stop applications if you can do the thing. Any other question on this first thing? Because some of these things we are going to elaborate on. Okay, so these are our materials. Okay, so you have dilutely doped some semiconductor defined very broadly with a magnetic element, mostly manganese. So let me now tell you what are the features. You have carriers, and both electrons and holes have been seen. But most of the interesting one, gallium manganese arsenide, indium manganese arsenide, these two certainly, and I'll be mostly talking about these two, are holes. So the carriers, manganese goes at a deep level, manganese at 5½ D level, so it creates a level in the valence band, which is about 100 to 140 MeV above the valence band top, right? You understand what I'm talking about? I don't have a picture, but this is not necessarily a semiconductor community, so this is the picture of a cartoon of there are many valence bands. You know, I should draw it like this. There is spin orbit coupling, several valence band. Conduction band is simple, and this is about 1.5 electron volt. Okay, 1500. And when you put manganese, if you do simple calculation, you have a manganese D level here, which is about, I don't remember the exact number, of the order of 0.1 electron volt. So it's a deep level, but not very deep. So the idea is that when you put a lot of this manganese here, okay, so this manganese, now if I do a band structure, so here is your, let's say, valence band, and here is your conduction band, and you have a manganese level here, but if you put a lot of manganese, it's possible that, you know, there is this level broadens and it gets combined with the valence band, and the impurity and the electrons are, holes are really in the valence band. Okay, but whether that is the case or not is very hotly being debated. Meaning all band structure calculation, at least all the ones I know of, show that what happens is not this at all, but what happens is that you get a well-defined impurity band in here. You can see there's a very big difference whether the action is in the impurity band here, impurity band, okay, or in the valence band. And I really have nothing to add to that. I think that it probably depends on parameters and so on. But even this is debated. Even this is not quite known. For the carriers and the impurity band and the valence band, yes.
And the temperature is such that if you have a separate impurity band, the carriers would stay in the impurity band.
Yeah, because you're talking about TC for this material is of the order of 120 Kelvin. So, you know, so 100 MeV is, as you know, 1500 Kelvin, 1300 Kelvin. So, yeah. So that effect, I mean, all the calculations include that effect. That's a trivial effect, yeah. So, you know, so but one doesn't know. It may very well be they're all in the valence band. I mean, this is still being discussed, yes.
Yeah, just to add one thing to that. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So regarding the impurity band and the valence band, it's generally believed there is an impurity band at sufficiently low concentration of X. And so
right.
X is the amount of
matter. Yeah, that's what I meant, yeah.
Order 1%, but as the...
No, this is completely false. It's generally believed. That's maybe what you believe.
Okay.
But it's not generally believed for sure.
Okay, so I believe, and others yeah. believe, not all everyone,
no.
that around 1% you have a well-formed impurity band in gallium manganese arsenide, but for 5% doping, it's generally thought that the valence band describes.
Yeah, so this is what my shading means. That's exactly what I said. But if you put a lot of manganese, then it overlaps with the valence band. You know, so there is, and this question is very hard to answer. So the valence band goes like this, and they overlap. This is what I meant when you put a lot. Clearly, at some concentration of manganese, that's going to happen, obviously. Where that happens, band structure cannot help us very much. But you know, if you talk to someone like Alex Zunger, who is very strongly opinionated, much more strongly opinionated than even I am, you know, he would say that all these valence band pictures are completely false. I don't know if he's still saying that or not. Certainly he was saying that a year ago. That, you know, all these valence band pictures, these people don't know what they're talking about. All these models are wrong. He doesn't even want to look at your, you know, starting Hamiltonian, saying there is no carrier, you know. So what I'm saying is that I do not disagree with what you said, but it's not generally believed by the band structure community, who may know more about this than we do. Okay, it's a pity Nicola is not here. I'm sure she could have added some more information on that. For me, it's a matter of profound inconsequence. Whatever there, we should be able to do a theory.
Right. You know. I don't want to derail this thing.
Right. Right.
But I mean, it's an acceptor level. Presumably, right. Pretty spread out. I mean, the Bohr radius in this thing is
six angstrom.
Six angstrom.
Yeah, it's very small.
6 angstrom.
Yes, right. That's it. It's connected. It's deep. 0.1 electron volt. 0.1 is deep. This is the issue. Otherwise, there'll be no problem. Otherwise, it's all valence band. No, it is an issue. It's only, yeah.
So it's predominantly manganese.
Okay,
yeah, manganese character. But the point he's making is the important point. Now, I put a lot of manganese, right? Impurity band starts broadening and the valence band starts broadening. They become one and the same. Where and is it really, you know, are you in that regime or not? Somehow you'll be in that regime. But, you know, this is not something that's going to be answered from band structure calculations or model calculations. It eventually has to be answered by experiment. And if you look at experiments, the original experiments all kind of indicated this valence band, optical experiments. You know, the experiment here on MCD from Oshalam's group said valence band, experiment from Basav's group, Basav is very active in it. Originally, he wrote a PRL saying it's all in the impurity band. But now they are changing their picture and they said they did not quite know. So I think this is an important question, but which we are not going to be able to answer now. Okay, second important point for this community.
Yes. This band is D, manganese D band.
Manganese D band.
Conduction happens in the D level, not in the S level.
No, it's D, all D. Right, no, it's D. We're talking D. Manganese D level, 5½.
But it's hybridized with arsenic P.
Arsenic P. So here is arsenic P. Okay, so it's strongly hybridized with arsenic P. So the coupling here, the J is PD coupling, you know, like we have SF coupling in rare earths is PD coupling. Okay. It's very similar to rare earths, except the numbers. Okay. So one thing that is important for this community is because we like condolatis and
sorry,
yes.
But then I got confused. Because so Leon was asking about the Bohr radius. So that's like a typical semiconductor picture in which impurity just provides an I.
Yeah, but you have to listen to me carefully. When you put many, many manganese, then that picture is just Bohr radius is appropriate for one.
Even for a single one.
Right. Single one.
Maybe there's a confusion here. So it turns out that the
maybe I'm not understand
the
question.
Function of an acceptor, a hole around this manganese, has a D wave character
right.
to it.
Right.
And it's bound in a non hydrogenic.
It's not, hydrogenic. I just.
So
yeah.
It will be compared.
Right, oh, sure. Yeah, and its size is of the order of 6 angstroms. Yeah, its size of the, that's what I answered. I mean, you know, it's not a Bohr radius. It's certainly not a hydrogenic level. Okay.
It's very large for a D level.
Yeah, it's large. It's large. You know, yeah, it's large for a D level, but it's not large in the sense Leon was asking. Okay. So moments, you know, we are in this community. We think of condolatis and so on. So you need to remember the moment is very large here. You know, spin half, 5½. These, even the holes are mostly spin 3½. So it's large, these are localized, and essentially classical until you go to very low temperature, which, you know, quantum effects may be important at very low temperature, but nobody considers quantum effect as, you know, condo-type physics arising from the magnetic moment. So ferromagnetic, and this is a question that already came up, ferromagnetism in these systems is observed independent of whether the carriers are localized or itinerant in the transport sense. I'm going to show you data. Transport could be activated, transport could be basically temperature independent, there's ferromagnetism, but TC seems to depend strongly on whether it's localized or itinerant, and TC in general for localized systems seems to be lower, and as Greg said, that it seems that localized systems have low manganese concentration. And it may very well be that's impurity band, that's why they're localized. Impurity band is localized, and once manganese concentration is large, it all goes into valence band and TC is higher. It's consistent with that picture, but whether that is happening or not, one doesn't know.
The reason why the single impurity condo scale is so low is because the original density of states of the semiconductor is low. Right?
That's very low too.
Right.
If you look at the...
If I was putting manganese
it's actually not, it's not actually that low, you know. We calculated, Andy Billis and I looked at it. We don't want to make a big deal of it because you don't want this to be condo physics. Condo physics is very well studied. In the order of 100 millikelvin or so, it's not like incredibly low, you know. It's not like it cannot be seen, okay? But it's not for people are doing experiments, okay?
Sure.
Yeah.
But it's below magnetic ordering.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, way below.
So it's 100 Kelvin forwards on the highest doping that you have.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, if when you bring the TC down to 5 Kelvin, this number goes down below 100 millikelvin. So it's, you know, it's a large difference, factor of 1,000, maybe not 1,000, maybe factor of 500, yeah. Okay, so it's experimentally known that the ferromagnetic critical temperature, I'm going to show you all these results, I'm just summarizing, depends sensitively on conductivity and annealing, okay? So TC is a complicated function of whatever coupling constants you have, which may not be parameterized by just one coupling constant, impurity density, This is something you control. Carrier density is something you do not control, and all kinds of disorder. One thing I didn't mention, but it's here, is that in these systems are in a different regime of parameter space compared with what you are used to if you come from metal physics. Manganese local moment density is much higher than the carrier density here, often by a factor of 10. Now you may ask, how is that possible? Each manganese D level contributes exactly one hole to the valence band, let's say. How can it be higher? Well, one doesn't quite know why many of the, 190% or 80% or 50% of the carriers are missing. It's thought that it's because there are these interstitials, there are these anti-sites, and many of the carriers are just compensators. So this is like a very heavily compensated semiconductor. And if you do not know what compensated, it basically means the carrier density is much lower than you would have thought it to be, okay? It really is, okay, because of other defects. And this turns out to be a very important point of physics, because we are predicting that if carrier density is comparable to impurity density, TC will be much lower, actually. So why is this of some relevance to this program? Why is it mentioned? I think it's mentioned in our write-up, original write-up. It's because you have disorder. You have ferromagnetic and antiferromagnetic interaction. So other phases at low temperature are not only possible, I would say they're likely. And in fact, the kind of phases that could arise, you could definitely have a valence bond solid phase. It will be random, probably. It will not be probably valence bond lattice. But random valence bond solid phase is certainly possible. Spin glass phases, absolutely guarantee are there. Nobody's doing experiments here below 5 Kelvin, okay? I'm trying to get Jim Eisenstein. Jim Eisenstein is now has samples. He's going to do some experiments. Peter Schiffer, who was Doug Asher's student, also wants to do it. And I'm sure if you go to low temperature, you're going to do some interesting physics. But you understand funding is coming from technological push, so there is not much interest in doing experiments below helium temperature. Even there is no interest even at helium temperature. Okay, so it's tough going, but once the application angle gets subdued a little bit, that's already happening actually. Maybe experiments will happen. So I'm. Spin glass is boring, but other phases. Conventional spin glass will be boring. I'm hoping it will not be conventional spin glass. I completely agree. But some of the other phases. Another, there are other complications. Again, these other complications may be very, very important for, as a matter of practicality, band structure, spin orbit coupling, and so on. But we heard about that in the talk, and it's not clear how, quote unquote, fundamental they are in talking about various phases. They may be. Okay, I'm not saying they're not, because these are holes. Remember, whole band structure is always complicated. So, so the basic mechanism that more or less everybody agrees with is that you have a coupling, either antiferromagnetic, ferromagnetic, between the manganese moment and the hole moment, okay, the carrier moment, so big S and small s. And then this coupling, this exchange is just an exchange coupling. This then mediates an effective coupling between the manganese moments, okay, so you can kind of integrate the holes out, quote unquote. And so this effective interaction between the two manganese moments, if it's ferromagnetic, then you could have a ferromagnetic transition. And if that's large, you could have a ferromagnetic transition high temperature. And in fact, this was the original proposal for extending ferromagnetism in metals also. I don't know how many of you know that. This is a Frolich-Nabarro mechanism for ferromagnetism in iron, cobalt, and nickel, 1946. Okay, they wrote a paper where they said, look, nuclei have spins, and nuclei spin will polarize the electron spin in a metal, and this polarization will be carried from one electron to another, and that will polarize the next nucleus, and you have ferromagnetism. Later on, this was worked out by Ruderman and Kittel in details, and that's called RKKY interaction. And then they immediately calculated the TC, and was of course very disappointed. So just based on this, you said this TC is going to be whatever the nuclear, say there's some J in front, and whatever the energy scale for this this thing is divided by EF. Okay, so this is going to be the energy. I don't even need JJs.
Were
so
talking about nuclears?
They were talking about nuclears, and then they, they're smart guys. They found this is below a microkelvin. Okay, so they said, well, this was very interesting, but it cannot. But in this, the basic thing is still the same. All the mean field theory in this subject should, instead of calling it Dittel mechanism, they should call it Frolich-Nabarro mechanism. What has happened now? This delta now is of the order of 10 to 50 MeV. Instead of being microvolt, and EF is of the order of, also, J is large also. So it's of the order of, 50 to 100 MeV also. So this number has changed from some huge number, 10 to the minus 6 or something, to something like 1.
What J is dimensionless?
Yeah, J is dimensionless, the way I'm writing it. Yeah. But I mean, this is just a standard power arbitration theory dimensional argument. There is nothing profound here, okay? The magnetic energy scale and the electron energy scale. So if you lower the Fermi energy and increase some of the magnetic energy scale, you are in business. And that's what this thing is. That's what this thing is. So, you know, so the point now is that you can see this is very important because we know, going back to the work of, you know, RKKY work, that if you, carrier density is very large, then the interaction is not necessarily ferromagnetic, and these details will then matter. So this was the first paper that came out in a regular physics journal. Everything before that were applied physics letters because they were just developing the material. This is work of Ono. And what I'm showing you is TC, measure TC, as a function of manganese concentration in gallium manganese arsenide. And the open symbols mean that resistivity for these open symbols were insulating-like. They were going up, I'll show you the resistivity also. They're going up very fast with, as you decrease temperature. And the closed symbols mean they're metallic. Metallic should be quote-unquote, it's a very bad metal. Basically means the temperature dependence was not very strong, resistivity temperature dependence. As you can see, picture hasn't changed much. This is 1998. Picture hasn't changed much in 6 years. Now it goes up and then becomes kind of constant or comes down a little bit. And TC has gone up from 120 to something like 160. But it's incremental advance, okay? It's not, no revolution has taken place, and this basic picture is still valid. So let me show you the what happened to the resistivity? I want to show you the resistivity first, here. So this figure goes with the figure I just showed you, this one, okay? This was in the same FISREV. So here you can see what is happening, resistivity, as a function of T for various values of X. So what I'm showing here, and again, this picture hasn't changed much either, only change in details. So these are the manganese concentration. Manganese concentration here is shown 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 manganese concentration increasing from 1.5%, which is insulating, to 7%, which is insulating also. So there is a reentrant behavior, which you already saw in the other figure, right? This is insulating, this is also insulating. Okay, so somehow both of these are insulating. Intermediate values of X is quote-unquote metallic. Now, you know, how metallic it is, you can judge. Okay, so there is no temperature dependence. But at high temperature, they all look insulating. They're all going down in some monotonic manner. Look, this is a log scale, okay? Some monotonic manner, this is linear scale. And, you know, all of them, if you look at it, and if you expand this part, all of them at low enough temperature is, again, resistance is going up. I mean, my own conjecture is they're all actually insulating. This is very strongly insulating. This is not so strongly insulating. But the main point is resistivity is large. Okay, if you convert this resistivity into mobility, then over here, for this sample, mobility is of the order of 1. Okay? They are not even 50. Well, so
the ones which are nominally metallic, the peak is about TC?
Roughly. Not exactly, but roughly. And in fact, if you actually even look at these, you can see the derivative. There is a sign. And Alexey Kaminsky and my work show that there will be some feature here also, if they can have data fine enough. There is always some little anomaly. Yeah. This is all around TC. But could be off by 5 to 10%, okay? Could be off by 5 to 10%. But, you know, the way they measure TC here is open to question. These are not magnetic people, okay? They are not really, you know, doing all these plots that you're supposed to do to get TC very carefully. Getting TC is an art, so I think it's correct to say this is around TC. Here is a different material, germanium manganese, okay? The material developed at NRL. This is from their science paper in 2001. And here you see again, for low manganese concentration, strong insulating, and then whether you want to call it insulating, they call this thing metallic, this 3.3%, but you can see they stop here, because after that it becomes very non-metallic. It's a metal here, and it's not a metal here. And I have been telling them that the distinction between a metal insulator is only at zero temperature. Everything, but anyway, so you know, this is transport. Basic feature is that both metallic and insulating phases show ferromagnetism. Metallic phases typically show higher TC, but even the metallic phases, the resistivity is very high, and it's quite conceivable at a very low temperature. Fermi energy in these things are of the order of 500.
Including compensation.
Yeah. It's just looking at the meaning you cannot include compensation. Just measure the free carrier. That's another story. They really do not know the Fermi energy. I mean, you are asking all the difficult questions. To know Fermi energy, they didn't have to know carrier density. They have to know the mass. You do not measure. Fermi energy is not something you directly measure by any experiment. Okay? So you have to know mass. You already heard that people disagree on what the mass should be and so on. But it's certainly of the order of 500 Kelvin. Okay? It could be as low as 100 Kelvin, but not in these materials. Okay? All right, so now let me tell you that, as I told you before, that how things depend on annealing. Okay? So here is data from Penn State. Many other groups have similar data, at least 6 different groups. It's a very big worldwide activity, by the way. So, but what I'm showing you here is effect of annealing. So look at magnetization as a function of temperature. For the same sample, all these curves that you see are in the same sample, but different kind of annealing, okay? So star is as grown. Where is star? Star is as grown. Here is star. Okay, so as you can see, it looks very non-Brillouin-like, very different from magnetization curve in Kittel's book, very different from what you see in iron and cobalt. It looks almost linear, very different from the Brillouin function. But then they annealed it only for 10 minutes. It starts becoming better, more Minfield-like, TC goes up. But if they annealed it for a very long time, the system seems to be again degraded, TC goes down. So other groups claim that if they do annealing very carefully, they can improve this. Basic point is there are some impurities, something that's moving around. Okay, something moving around. And by annealing, they can get more Brillouin function type form. Here is a mean field calculation by Yu-Hian Huang at Maryland. And just ordinary mean field, but what you take into account are two features that you have a two-component system. It's actually a nice qualifying problem. You know, probably I'll give it in qualifying at Maryland. That you generalize Weiss theory for a two-component system, you know. And then what you'd have, do you have that theory here? Let me just show the theory here. So what you have is, so this is your Hamiltonian, right? So in general, you'll have coupling between the holes and the magnetic moment, and then you have external magnetic field. And you can also have anti-ferromagnetic coupling between the moments themselves. If you're doing mean field theory, it doesn't really matter. You can include everything. In mean field theory, there is no frustration. And then essentially what you'd say is that magnetization of the moment, the big M, depends on the magnetization of the moments themselves and also, you know, magnetization or spin polarization of the holes. Okay, you have to include that. Similarly, spin polarization or magnetization of the holes, this is free carrier, let's say, will depend on magnetization of the big moments, M, and you know, you can now iterate these things. And if you iterate these things,
this calculations neglect the distribution of exchange energy?
This particular calculation, as I said, that there are two mean field people do special, but we have of course done that more recently, and this was a PRL by us last year. If you include that, you get much better agreement. But I'm saying even this ordinary mean field, this figure that I was showing you is just the ordinary mean field that can generate this very non-mean field type. You can generate very non-mean field type behavior from this ordinary mean field theory by having different values of carrier density and it's just, you know, just a feature of.
But your model does not have kinetic energy for holes.
No, it's just spin polarization. I don't understand why. I mean,
your holes have to hop.
No, these are free carriers. I mean, this is just.
He's integrated out the holes.
Yeah, I'm going to integrate them out. Yeah, I mean, you know, for even iron and cobalt, mean field theory for the shape works. It's Brillouin function. You can look at it. It looks very much except this Dyson term. You know, it's very small.
Why it's ferromagnetic? It's because pore radius of carrier is larger.
No.
No,
but it's ferromagnetic because carrier density is very small. So you never see the anti-ferromagnetic oscillations. You're totally in the ferromagnetic part. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so. Same thing. Yeah. So there are some more curves for annealing, which I'm not going to discuss. So let me see what I missed. Okay. So this is some other germanium manganese magnetization. See, very concave here. In germanium manganese, I've never seen convex behavior.
If it is the case, in distance between two manganese is smaller than Fermi wavelengths, why do you take into account only the direct exchange? It's actually multiple exchanges, right?
All those things are done. I don't want to talk about my work. All those things are done. We have done all of those things. So this is, as I said.
The order of SSS,
yeah, which is appropriate. Yeah, yeah. All those things can be done, and they have been done. Problem is that you do not know the exact coupling. So, you know, taking this sort of theory to its limit is not very sensible because you don't know the free parameters. But what you're saying can be done. You know, we basically even include a mean free path effect using your work with Zizen and do the whole thing numerically. Say that, you know, that if the distance is very large, then it's a random function. If it's very small, it's RKQI. All those effects happen. And they have substantial effect on TC. And we get very good agreement with experiment using all those things. But, you know, for details, I'm just, this is a discussion, not talk of my work. Okay. So this is, for example, germanium manganese magnetization. Look how concave it is. It's very different. By the way, I should tell you that you may say, what about disordered magnetic glass, metallic magnetic glass? Do they see this kind of effect? Will disorder by itself? No. If you look at magnetic glasses, I went and talked to people who work on magnetic glasses, their magnetization curve is very much below function-like. There's almost no effect. Here, you see this tremendously concave result. And this was a simulation from Ravin Vaad's group several years ago, you know, where he did not comment on it, but he generates this concave thing.
What, random ferromagnetism?
Yeah. So this is what Boris was asking. So the huge distribution of exchange coupling. Okay, I mean, since this question is coming up, I'll show you some of the results. Okay. Yeah.
How was mobilization measured?
Measured here?
Yeah.
Well, the usual way. They use a squid. They use a squid and and then look at remnant here. Yeah.
So in a sense, they could not determine whether it's very sharp bracket peak at Q equals zero.
So we have a language problem here. This is semiconductor. This is all free electron light. Okay. So lattice physics doesn't play any role except perhaps for special disorder. Neutron scattering, people have done neutron scattering here, but it's not going to be a useful tool here because the length scales involved.
But if you see elastic peak, you can ask how sharp it is.
That has not been done. But this is all mostly transport and magnetization studies. There is one neutron paper, which is a very huge effort from Grenoble. And mostly for spin wave, like looking at spin wave, basically. It's not particularly conclusive because this is the, even you look at the length scales and the energy scales, it's really more semiconductor physics than magnetic physics. So what are the issues, some issues at least, okay? So mean field theory.
Does that curve fit to some Bolzmann function or?
No, it depends on all the details. It's not a well-known trigonometric function. But Brillouin function is basically not Lorentzian. Brillouin function is a particular integral. We call it Brillouin function.
No.
It's exactly the same kind of integral with this. I mean, it's really no more sophisticated than Brillouin function.
That one.
Yeah, no more sophisticated. I mean, I showed you that this thing can be generated. I'll come to this. So the questions that come up are things like impurity band. All these questions have already come up. Impurity band versus valence bands, insulating versus metallic, RKKY Zener versus double exchange, transport and magnetism correlations. Things that I didn't tell you, that often the saturation magnetization, like this value, sometimes is only 10% of the amount of manganese you have put in. So 90% of the manganese is missing. And again, whether this is an intrinsic effect, you have non-collinear ferromagnetism, or it's just, crap. Interstitials and anti-site and so on is not quite known. Originally, people thought it's non-collinear effect. Most people, I always thought it's crap because this is, very crappy material. And it seems that most people are now saying it's crap. The reason is that, yeah.
So you can check this by applying magnetic field and seeing quasi-mobilization changes?
It turns out that's very hard to do. Those are the kinds of experiments that are telling you that it's not non-collinear. Okay, but there are other models. The one model that Greg Fitt works with, where this frustration could have very high energy scale. So it's not completely settled, but there is no question that interstitials, anti-sites, they're reducing ferromagnetic saturation quite a bit. Whether that's 100% of the effect, I think, is still an open question. Do you agree with that, Greg? I mean, they will definitely reduce. If you have interstitials, those manganese don't contribute to ferromagnetism.
I think it's probably fairly clear at this point that the reduction of magnetization is not due to non-collinear effects.
Right, good. All right, so.
Probably crap.
Right, good. Okay, so we agree. Agreement is not easy among theorists in this field. Okay. That's already known experimentally.
Well, there are various energy scales involved, yeah. And it depends on what the concentration of X is. But sort of in the optimally doped samples, which are very metallic, it's not due to non-collinear effect, rather due to defects. So two manganese that sit next to each other tend to align antiferromagnetically. This effectively removes them from active magnetization. So you need a field strong enough to break that.
And that's very strong. That's like, tens of Tesla. Okay, so these are all the questions, are these things, saturation, are these things intrinsic or extrinsic and so on. So let me just tell you, this is a crude figure that I like, okay? So it is a carrier density, and here is the local moment density, okay? In general, we can ask, let's just imagine the system is metallic, okay? So most of the things that, theoretical condensed matter physicists have worked on is over here. So this is, Kondo, and you need to think of other axes coming out, which is value of the coupling, but let's forget about value of coupling, disorder of all kinds. So you have to imagine there's some kind of projection, there is disorder also, there is always disorder. So you have Kondo here, where you have the carrier density is very high, and the local moment density is basically zero, very few local moments. And then you have Kondo lattice over here somewhere where they're roughly equal. So these are the regions that, smart theorists work on, okay? But technologically, they're not particularly significant. So now, here is spin glass, you have strong disorder. Somewhere all over here will be spin glass if you have strong disorder, all over this green region. Look at where these diluted magnetic semiconductors are. This is why I think fundamentally people should pay attention to it. It's in a regime of parameter space in which we didn't have any magnetic materials before. That's a statement of fact, okay? That it's in a regime of parameter space where you have ferromagnetism somewhere here. You definitely have antiferromagnetism for the reason Greg Fitt just mentioned, when the manganese is sitting very close together, you know, if you just had a manganese lattice, for example, you know, strong antiferromagnetic coupling somewhere here. And if you have disorder, we have very specific predictions that over here there'll be valence bond state, and depending on disorder, maybe in spin glass, a random valence bond state. And this is the part that hasn't been studied much. People do not study this regime and this regime at all while ferromagnetism disappears, because that's the regime. People, most of the studies are so-called optimal doping. And you can see the difference in the high TC community.
You get rid of all the gallium, or what is
No. This is 7-8%. Not all. This is 7-8% only. Yes. This regime is 7-8%. Remember, I showed you the TC starts going up, down the moment you have manganese above 5%. By the time manganese 8%, TC is zero. You know, that's fine. No, but the numbers matter. You know, so this is. I can go back to that.
No.
Yeah. Okay. So, but numbers matter. Okay.
It's a relevant regime for experiments, you're saying.
Total, no, not irrelevant regimes for experiments, of course. Experimentalists are not studying it. Like, you know, like in high TC, since everybody has forgotten about any practical aspects, people are studying all the regimes which are of physics interest, maybe, but not a practical interest, okay? Here, you're not going to make any experimentalist study this regime, okay? I mean, Nitin Samat, you know, I mean, I talked to him and he said, I'll do it, but I don't think he's doing anything, okay? Just the how fast he's saying yeah tells me that, you know, he's not doing it, okay? So I want him to study this regime. I want to study. He cannot say no, I will not, because I tell him how interesting it is. You know, this regime is boring. You know, I tell him this regime is boring. It was worked out by, you know, Frolich and Nabor in 1946. I mean, and so I think there are exotic, not as exotic as, you know, deconfined criticality.
Chankar, so the physical reason why this happens at, you know, relatively small x, not
yes,
10 or 8,
right,
and it's
right.
Semiconductor standard,
right.
But still it's a lot smaller than one.
Right.
It's just that the direct manganese-manganese exchange is very large.
Very large. That's of the order of electron volt.
Magnetism is mediated by
right.
a very low carrier density.
Why is it so large?
Oh, because it's very, it's
a type of bond in the orbiter.
No. They have to be that. No. You are confusing two things. You're confusing two things. Large versus range. They are very small. They're zero if they're sitting far from each other. But when they're sitting next to each other, it's very large. It's a nearest neighbor coupling, basically.
Only nearest neighbor on the gallium.
It's
why 7%?
Yeah, I think it's
the range. It's this. No.
It's combined with the ferromagnetism, which is weak.
No.
It's divided by the.
Subir.
At what distance is the air?
Yeah.
Two
statements are merging here. When I told you that by 7% TC disappears, that's an experimental fact. Where theoretically you expect this physics to come in depends on models and so on. And we find around 10% that becomes very important. And that's taking into account the kind of physics Boris was asking about, the distribution of exchange and in the strongly localized regime, the paper that you was gracious enough to accept on PRL, where you talk about what happens, an exact theory doing percolation, or you can do an exact theory, those numbers are around 10% or above. Okay, so it seems there is sufficient interaction in that regime that you can see these things. But what it happens experimentally, I'm saying, is 7-8%. But as we improve the material, it's getting pushed a little bit higher. The group in Nottingham, which is really the, you know, most careful group now, they claim that they see ferromagnetism maybe all the way up to 8.5%, which is nobody else sees that. Okay, so this is the question that will, you know, that probably is going to change. But my point is this, and this is the interesting regime for this community. And other than three papers from Maryland, there's no other paper on that subject. None.
How big is the nearest neighbor? The J, the direct exchange?
It's not known what it is in gallium arsenide,
you
see. So we in our calculation, we use the number sometimes 20 times, sometimes 10 times, sometimes 50 times. The results do not depend much, just where the phase diagrams. But it's, if I talk to band such people, they would say it's much more than 10 times. They would say it's 100 times.
Times what?
J, the ferromagnetic, the basic exchange coupling between carriers and the local moment. This is the energy scale. These are the two energy scale.
Okay.
One is J antiferromagnetic, one is J ferromagnetic.
Yeah.
So
J antiferromagnetic, a number?
Oh, number, sure. It's of the order of 100 millielectron volt.
Okay.
Because J ferromagnetic, but it's very short range. J ferromagnetic is, you know, of the order of 10 to 20 MeV. Okay. I mean, If you talk to bandstock people, be very careful. They define all these things in a totally different way. It's very confusing. They have centimeter cube in all their energy units.
Yeah.
So you got to convert it into our units. Yeah. Then it's of the order of 10 to 20 MeV ferromagnetic coupling, yeah. And above 100 MeV this antiferromagnetic coupling. The antiferromagnet is very short range.
So it's roughly this factor of 10 is what's pushing you down, right. Relatively small.
A factor of 10. Absolutely.
So concentration from ferromagnetic to antiferromagnetic is basically the ratio of these two energy scales.
Not quite. It depends on how much disorder you have also. Suppose you put them exactly, if you take the manganese and put them exactly 10 nearest neighbors apart or 5 nearest neighbors apart, you'll never see antiferromagnetism, right? So our point is that you need disorder also.
Take J, direct times the probability to have it.
Exactly. That's precisely what comes into the theory.
That's
precisely what comes into the theory. But there are claims, and you know, our speaker, Karsten Tim, showed us that it's clustering of manganese for energetic, Coulomb energetic reason. If that happens, then that may explain why 7% lower than what you'd expect. You know, that makes explain why. But you know what the phase is? The phase is clearly cannot be a simple antiferromagnet. It's very random. You have exchange distribution. Okay, so let me just keep all the. I mean, you know, we can get more or less good agreement with the experimental magnetization just from the mean field theory. But let's. So this is the Hamiltonian. We like Hamiltonian, so this is the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian is you have band states, holes for gallium manganese arsenide. You have some disorder which is interacting with the band states. This disorder is very, very strong. You have the basic condo coupling between, you know, the local moment and the holes, and then have antiferromagnetic interaction between the holes themselves and between the local moments themselves. And if you can solve this Hamiltonian, you know, you have the problem solved in a random system.
Just to recap, you have the ferromagnetic interaction that's mediated by the carrier.
Right.
Then you have the direct antiferromagnetic,
right. So,
short range.
Yeah, that's this one.
It's very short range.
Yeah, that's this one.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then in the picture before, you had the critical density for which antiferromagnetism establishes.
I would not go to the extent calling critical density. Some rough densities. Yes, right.
But that's, for that density, you still have very small overlap. I mean, the distance between the.
That depends on the probability of finding something.
The antiferromagnetic part of the indirect exchange becomes important.
Yeah, that's also becomes important. I mean, there are many things. Let me. Can you just hold on? Yeah. Can you hold on? Yeah. Can you hold on these questions? I mean, all these things we thought about. Okay. I mean, so when you look at the numbers, I mean, you have to take this thing where this happens. Do not really get stuck with the number 7%, 10%, and so on. Answer is one doesn't know this number because this is not a universal number where this happens. This depends on the parameters of this Hamiltonian. If that's what you're saying, the answer is correct. And by suitably tuning parameters of this Hamiltonian, you can make this happen wherever you want.
So he's just sort of asking qualitatively what's happening in physics. And I think the answer that you're looking for is that, so there's a short range antiferromagnetic interaction, which is always antiferromagnetic, and it falls off at some distance. And then there's this longer range indirect interaction, which is typically ferromagnetic, and that's what gives rise to the ferromagnetism.
Right.
But as soon as the carrier concentration gets large enough, then you move off of the ferromagnetic part of that indirect interaction and start moving into the
So that doesn't answer that question. But over here, you have all kind of spin glass phase also for the reason Greg is mentioning. And you know, since you're asking these things, I'm going to show you. We have a paper specifically addressing this question. I don't want to get into all those technical details because the phase boundary obviously depends on all the numbers you're putting in, including the exchange distribution arising from disorder. So in our calculations, we assume the disorder to be absolutely random. And then you put some correlation in, this thing then changes, you know, where this diagram lines are and where this line is. This line gets suppressed because of the physics you're asking about. There are just far too many parameters to answer this question in the abstract, okay? But when I get there, maybe, so this is the Hamiltonian, and this we already discussed. I don't want to discuss DMFT, I mean, because I talked about it here 2 years ago, okay? And I'm a big DMFT fan, but I don't want to talk about DMFT because it's just DMFT here is a nice way of doing the mean field theory. You know, it actually has a tremendous thing. When you did it, I was very pleased about it. DMFT doesn't make an approximation about whether it's impurity band or valence band. Everybody, because what it is that this picture is put forward is this camp is in impurity band, this camp is in valence band. You know, double exchange coupling or RKKY coupling. The truth is, in reality, it's a smooth crossover from one to the other. Okay, absolutely smooth. Okay, it depends on how strong the exchange coupling is. If exchange coupling is very, very strong, Hund's rule dominates, then you have double exchange. If exchange coupling is weak, then you have the part arbitrary regime, and the part arbitrary regime is called RKKY interaction. Okay, so you know, so the fact of the matter is that DMFT, since it's non-part arbitrary, is a nice way of doing that. And you know, Andy and I did that with Amit Chattopadhyay, and we showed that this debate is in some sense a debate of ignorance, since you don't know what the coupling constant is. You know, if you think the coupling constant is large, you say it's impurity band and double exchange. If you think coupling constant is weak, so that you can do RKKY perturbative calculation, you call it RKKY. But in reality, it's the same picture because the MF is non. And that's the good thing that came out of DFT. So I was not going to talk about that, but since all the questions that came up are related to this, we have two physical letters last year dealing with all the questions that are coming up. Okay. So what we did is. No. These questions are specifically coming up. What about disorder? What about antiferromagnetic interaction? And what we did is exactly what you guys are asking. Okay, exactly that. It's the most common sense, reasonable thing to do. Take the original Hamiltonian, keep the special disorder exactly, and then either do Monte Carlo or whatever else you can. And there we had a smart angle compared to everybody else. We said thermal fluctuations are not very important in this problem because coordination number is very large, distance are very large. We're going to do a thermal mean field theory, but special disorder we're going to include exactly. Okay, and then you can include all these things, antiferromagnetic interaction. So what we did is, you know, we just created the gallium arsenide lattice.
Wait, can you say that one more time? So you have exact spatial disorder?
Exact spatial disorder. The thermal fluctuations. Yeah. So we do not do virtual crystal approximation. We do a thermal mean field theory for the exact lattice problem. And we could not find any other context anybody has done it. So I was kind of shocked. Somebody must have done it in some other problem. Usually mean field people do everything mean field. And numerical people do everything Monte Carlo. And you may ask, why didn't you do Monte Carlo? Well, we started doing Monte Carlo, and then you realized we'll never be able to make comments about TC that are reasonable doing Monte Carlo for the standard limitations of Monte Carlo. Okay. So we take gallium arsenide lattice, randomly put manganese there, randomly with some correlation if it's known, and then this was your exchange distribution. So we can calculate. This is probability of finding some particular value of exchange coupling. You know, all the details depend on what kind of disorder you're putting in. But this is what is completely ignored in the mean field theory. Mean field theory is taken to be one number. And as you can see, you can even have bimodal distribution depending on where you are. I really don't want to go through all these things. It depends on how localized the system is, how non-localized the system is, all these things. But the fact of the matter is the exchange distribution. So what this is, probability of finding a particular value of exchange coupling between holes and manganese. And what you do, you can exact, and then the calculation is exact because you can have literally trillions of atoms here. It's essentially exact calculation, okay? But we are ignoring thermal fluctuations. And you know, you can show when the system will have concave magnetization, when it will have convex magnetization, and you can get how TC. So this is the physics people are asking me about. So when NC goes up, when critical density goes up, ferromagnetism is suppressed. And this is for the reason that Boris, you are asking me because you have the antiferromagnetic part of RKKY interaction coming in. But when the, so this is all, basically you will have at first, when you increase carrier density, TC will go up, then it will come down. Remember, in our theory, I think this is what Leon was just commenting on, our theory only have ferromagnetism. But when TC comes down, there may very well be other competing phases which you know over because the way the theory is constructed, it looks only for ferromagnetism. So, you know, so we have to go beyond it. We are going beyond it right now. Here, I have started a collaboration with Anders Sandvik to look for the other phases because this is in, I thought, people who do this as a profession can do this better than we can. So, but anytime TC is coming down, we expect other phases. And similarly, you have results, what happens when manganese density goes up. So if manganese density goes up, you will have ferromagnetism suppressed also. And, you know, so antiferromagnetic suppression of TC. And again, in this mean field theory, thermal mean field theory, we are not going to get those other phases, okay? Those other phases we do by doing other arguments, which I'm not going to talk about because I think this is enough. We can actually calculate TC. So the next thing is, you know, one can do an exact percolation theory in the localized regime, but this is quite technical. And one has Griffith's phase, and one can get a valence bond phase also. Within this percolation model, all of this is valid in the strongly localized regime. In the strongly localized regime, the nature of ferromagnetism here is purely percolation ferromagnetism, and this was extensively studied in the former Soviet Union in the 70s. Our new input here has been to make the difference between metals and semiconductors. Semiconductors are very different from metals in the way the coupling works, and then you find that this percolation theory basically can be done analytically. And in the strongly localized phase, you can actually get the phase diagram reasonably, qualitatively reasonably well. But in the metallic regime, of course, this doesn't work. So I'm going to stop here. I'm hoping some other people will make some comments. I mean, I can show you the phase diagram we obtained. This is not in my notes. I have to, in the metallic phase, this is the phase diagram we are, can I turn the light on and maybe, where is the light? So this is actually, I'm showing this because these are the questions that are coming up. So now in the metallic regime, so I'm going to show you, maybe first show you the insulating regime phase diagram, which is theoretically, I'm going to go through a lot of stuff because this is towards the end. Here, basically, it's a paramagnet. It's not paramagnet. It's paramagnet hut. Here. So this is an analytic work. We cannot put any numbers. So what we find is that you have, again, it's as a function of imperial density, same as the figure I was showing you before, but in the strongly localized regime, okay? So the system has to be, so you find a ferromagnetic phase here. We find some kind of random antiferromagnetic phase here, and our very recent work shows that by doing,
No.
This work that I'm talking about, as I told you right in the beginning, everything is assumed to be classical except one of our very recent pieces of work where Viktor Galitsky.
I'm just talking about his paper.
Right, so this is not classical spin here, obviously. So this is the quantum critical point. This is a zero temperature. There will be a quantum critical point is what we're predicting. So,
not necessarily.
No, I'm not saying this is the result of actual theoretical calculation.
You're acting from magnetic field. It's random, you have static spins, but in random orientation.
Right. So
could may well just be a classical.
No, it's not obvious at all. I'm not saying it's obvious. This is not just some hand-waving thing saying it's a quantum critical point.
Check out a really stupid question.
Right.
What kind of lattice do the galliums form?
Gallium by itself? Just gallium metal?
No, the gallium.
Oh, gallium arsenide, zinc blend. Okay. Zinc blend, so it's FCC. Two interpenetrating FCC. It's called zinc blend structure.
So the gallium on its own is an FCC.
Right. Subit, I'll give you the paper and then we can discuss this. It's not clear at all. There'll be a quantum critical point here. I completely agree.
Can you quantize? So it's phase transition zero temperature. Two classically ordered phases.
So it's conceivable that I mean, now I don't want to get in the minutiae of this thing, but the important point is, let's forget that, let's say the quantum critical point word is not there, okay? Basic point is there are various phases here, and now we know that one phase here for large Ni is actually a valence bond phase. We can show that in some situations the antiferromagnetic coupling will form singlets and the ground state is just a random, It's you know, random ordering of this singlet pairs, okay?
But I thought if you have this kind of singlets, it slowly will produce some kind of spin one halves, which will have some residual antiferromagnetic order.
No, that depends on the number and so on.
No.
You can have antiferromagnetic, but you also can have a valence bond phase. Both are possible. Which? Yeah, but this one is frozen.
So the lattice of gallium, these things, I mean, the manganese can be frustrated. On that lattice.
This is what we are thinking about. We are doing it because we don't think the material will ever have that geometric frustration because of the way they make it. But you are right. There could be geometric frustration also. So let me just finish by telling you what the phase is, and they may or may not be quantum phases that one expects for metallic, okay? So for metallic, let me first define the quantities I'm going to be using. So there are three parameters in the problem, okay? L, which is mean free path. So that determines how metallic the system is. And then Ri, which is essentially or rather proportional to 1 over cube root of Ni. So this is the distance between manganese ions, manganese moments, and Rc, which is proportional to 1 over square root of n cube. We are not talking about two-dimensional system, although nothing will change. So there are three length scales in the problem. Mean free path, which determines how metallic the system is and what exactly happens with RKKY oscillations. And then Ri, which is the typical separation, average separation between manganese impurities, and Rc, which is the typical average separation for holes. Normally, remember that Rc is much, much larger than Ri, but much, much means just a couple of times, okay, two or three times, okay? So now you can see that the phase diagram, you have to three variables, so it's very difficult. So I'm going to draw a phase diagram I don't want to draw a three-dimensional phase diagram. I'm going to draw three different phase diagrams showing how you get different phases that you vary this, with the other parameters kept at optimum, because otherwise it would be too complicated. Even I cannot visualize it, okay? So This is picture A, where only thing we are varying is this RC, the average separation in carriers.
Jack, are all this stuff is supposed to be going on above or below the percolation threshold for the?
Oh, no, no. Oh, sorry, I confused
if
you.
If I just start laying
percolation
down.
Right. Percolation threshold here is X is 0, but TC depends exponentially on that. So TC will be, so this is all above the percolation threshold.
What's the nearest neighbor percolation threshold, Shankar?
What?
Yeah, that's
the nearest neighbor percolation threshold. It's around 16%.
It's around 16%.
Okay. So then.
Is that right?
This is the now. I'm now completely confused. What percolation threshold are you talking about?
Nearest neighbor.
What?
Shut off the indirect exchange and just had direct exchange to focus. You know, enhance the antiferromagnetic effects. And what
it is? It is
X. What I have to.
It
do.
Is above. Okay, it's just above.
16%.
Well, yes, yeah, so just above. Yes.
So that critical point is what constant.
Over here, you're going to have some antiferromagnetism. Over here, you're going to have some antiferromagnetism, right? So over here, there'll be a phase at some large value of Ni, which will be the antiferromagnetic phase.
I thought you said the ferromagnetic phase ended around 8%.
That's the experimental finding.
Oh, okay.
Whether that's intrinsic or not, nobody knows.
And on this
we have no numbers on this thing, okay? Because this is just a purely non-number theory, okay? This particular one has no number whatsoever. This just says, this is very much in the spirit of the exotic, right?
The only number that you'll give is a number of 8%, which is less than the percolation.
No, what experimentally this number has been changing. It was originally 6%. It has gone up to 8.5% now.
Yeah, all I'm saying is the only number which you will give, which is the experimental end of the ferromagnetism.
For the strongly insulating regime.
Is less than the nearest neighbor.
Absolutely.
Percolation.
Absolutely.
So this is the nearest neighbor in the lattice.
Yeah.
But the range second of the interaction is larger than the lattice constant.
You mean the anti-ferromagnetic interaction.
The anti-ferromagnetic range is larger than the lattice constant.
Not much.
Well, but it's about. It could make the difference between
A. I mean, I do not want anybody to take this seriously.
Down by factor 10 or something.
Look, this is an exotic graph. I don't want anybody to take it seriously. All one is pointing out here. Look, there is a serious one. All one is pointing out these phases are possible, okay? And now whether they're probable or not is where all these questions become relevant. And we have not done that yet. And unless experimentally show interest, I'm not going to do that. Because that's, you know, that's hard calculations. So these phases are certainly possible. But whether they happen or not, I do not know. So let me just finish by showing you this in the metallic phase, what you'd expect, okay? So you'll have RKKY spin glass here. You'll have ferromagnetic here, okay? And then basically ferromagnetism will be all the way. So ferromagnetism will last all the way. So this is in the when you have let me take this out. Okay. So in the metallic system, if you keep the parameters mean free path pretty good conducting material, manganese density constant at some 5% optimum, then as you increase as you decrease density, remember this is decreasing density, okay? Decreasing density. Decreasing NC. As you decrease density, all that would happen is that ferromagnetism will become weaker. So you'll have TC first going up and then coming down. This is how TC will behave, but it will just remain ferromagnetic always. Okay. So B, let's say you are now varying the impurity, typical impurity distance, keeping everything else the same. So here now you are decreasing manganese. That's not the way experiment is done. Okay. But it's easier to think of the theory this way. So there, what you're going to have over here, you're going to have this some kind of random spin ordering. What the phase is, we do not know what the phase is. It could be this phase, it's something else, but it's not an RKKY spin glass. It could be a spin glass of some other kind, but you'll have some random spin order phase because it's a high concentration of manganese, okay? And then you have antiferromagnetic somewhere over there, but that's completely unphysical, I'm not even putting it. Then you have a ferromagnetic regime in the middle, and then up here, you're again going to have RKKY spin glass. Okay, because now the impedance is so low that the carrier density in effect is very large. So you have RKKY spin glass. And see, it turns out even as a function of mean free path, there is some interesting behavior. So this is the system is becoming more metallic as L increases, okay? From a bad metal or perhaps even from an insulating moment. So you'll have some kind of, you know, random glassy phase, but this random glassy phase will be different from either this one or that one. And then you have just ferromagnet, Okay. Now the discussion that is going on is what is the nature of this random spin-ordered state and the random glassy state, and I think that they remain, I mean, open what they are, and there's no experimental information whatsoever. This phase has been seen, I think, in 2-6 material.
I mean, in B, you might expect more structure inside the
ferromagnet. Oh,
maybe
yeah.
You get ferromagnetism on the lid.
Absolutely. This is not necessarily a saturated ferromagnetism. It could be ferrimagnet, all those things could be, but there will be long-range magnetic ordering here. In fact, I believe that, I mean, our work shows that much of this is basically ferrimagnet as long as you have some anti-ferromagnetic coupling, for example. Or there could be true ferrimagnetism, non-collinearity also. So when I say ferromagnet, let me put this, you have a finite TC, but the moment could be very low, okay? And yeah, I would not rule out more possibilities inside the ferromagnetic phase. I cannot rule that out, okay? Chris was going to say something.
Well, I was going to ask about a whole body of things, because okay. Back in the 1980s,
yes.
There was an interest in diluted magnetic semiconductors, and you're talking about, and you're focusing on the regime where there's a lot of magnetic impurities and not so many carriers around.
Correct.
And I guess I'm asking in what way the behavior of these differs from the behavior of those systems.
Yeah, I discussed at the beginning, yeah.
What's heavy magnetic telluride?
Yeah, right.
And for example, when people would dilute it, they would consider it to be a spin glass like phase, purely in the insulator. And then you had a small number of carriers, you'd have a random potential that would localize them like hydrogenetic impurities.
Yes.
And you had things called the bound magnetic polaron that would be forming. And I'm wondering why that is not part of the landscape in this.
Okay, so the answer is that these things I discussed in the beginning, you obviously came a little bit late, right? So I'll answer your question. And bound magnetic polaron is obviously very much, this whole theory that we talked about, that I didn't talk about, is based on the bound magnetic polaron picture, okay? Here is a bound magnetic polaron. The transition you're talking about, you know, we have a whole class of theory in the localized system, Alexei Kaminsky, Viktor Galitsky, and I, where we use this bound magnetic polaron picture, which goes back way before this 80s. This goes back to the Soviet school of 70s, okay? And we just adapted it. So answering the first part of the question is a very important point, that what is different here from dope 2-6 materials, which are the original diluted magnetic semiconductors. The difference is this, that in the original diluted magnetic semiconductor, manganese is not an acceptor. Manganese is not a dopant in the sense of semiconductors in 2-6 material when you look at the valence, okay? But it is in 3-5 material. So that means those cadmium manganese telluride, when you put manganese in it, it provided local moment, but there are no carriers. To get carriers, you have to dope them. And so almost, and you correctly said, almost all attempts with two exceptions of producing a ferromagnet, they basically failed, meaning they found spin glass phases. And eventually after a lot of work, they found ferromagnets with TC of the order of a few Kelvin, like the highest ever found of the order of 4 Kelvin. So the interest, it was clear cut that you're not going to produce a ferromagnet that way. And Hideo Ono and Munekata, who were postdocs at IBM in this 2-6 magnetic semiconductor group, had this idea that they can make 3-5 material by doping very, very carefully. Okay, 2-6 dope materials are very easy to create, but they are not ferromagnets. Not easily ferromagnets. 3-5 dope materials are very difficult to create, but they seem to be rather intrinsic ferromagnets.
The base diagram you were doing, the vertical axis was the carrier density.
Yes, correct.
So what you're really seeing, I think, is the lower line of that base diagram perhaps is not drawn correctly, because if you were literally on the zero line, you would see the ferromagnetism.
No, it doesn't go all the way to zero. It's some kind of log thing, obviously. Obviously, lower. As you go to NCD equal to zero, there'll be no ferromagnetism whatsoever. I mean, yeah, this is a very crude phase diagram.
Low carrier density, but you don't want to have it that low.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. So it doesn't go to zero. Absolutely. I'm sorry. Yes, I'll correct it. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. But did I answer both of your questions? Yes. And you know, I mean, it's not clear even doing this, one would get TC which is very high. You know, TC stuck below 200 Kelvin. And it may very well be that the problem 2-6 people faced, where they were stuck at 3-5 people are facing, they're stuck at 200. You know, it may very well be. And here also, you know, the whole localized situation, localized system, insulating ferromagnet, I think the correct picture is the picture of percolation of bound magnetic polarons. Now that also happens to be my picture, so it takes me very little to say the correct picture, but it's intuitively so obvious that it's some kind of magnetic polaron percolating that I'm willing to accept it as the correct picture.
So what about things like delta doping? If you make a thin layer of, let's say.
Yeah, that's what that Florida group did. Say it again.
Of what are manganese? So you said.
Yeah, that's what.
Arsenic, manganese.
Yeah. So they. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a very big subject.
So with a high transition temperature.
Yes. You
still yeah. Properties.
Yeah. You can. Yeah, people have even given it a name. That's a big thing here. Digital heterostructures. So they put manganese arsenide, gallium arsenide, manganese arsenide, gallium arsenide, a few mono layers of. Their TC is invariably much lower than the bulk material.
But one, even if you put, you're really like beating.
Manganese now is a bit farther away from the carriers. So the basic exchange coupling goes down. We expect it to be a bit lower. But perhaps, you know, disorder is a bit less also. So my understanding is that nobody has been able to reach TC of 100 Kelvin doing digital heterostructure. But, you know, there is, fundamentally there's not much of a difference. But in general, digital heterostructure seems to have lower TC than the bulk material. That's just a fact. My flippant answer, you know, very fast answer is, that's because that's what we expect. It's because.
I thought it was a clay from Oak Ridge that they have a higher transition.
Not in these materials. Oak Ridge people don't work in this material. It might be some other material then. Yeah. The highest, it's indeed true that this Tanaka. It's a different Tanaka than the one we have. His claim of this 160 is in a digital heterostructure also. But to really calculate TC there, you have to do a full band structure to see where the carriers are in this direction also. But I do not see fundamentally very much difference between.
It's probably tough to compare TCs. Everything depends so much on annealing. And
absolutely. In same material. I showed you, same material TC changes from 40 Kelvin to 120 Kelvin. Just by annealing between 10 minutes and 2 hours, you know. So talking about TC, I mean, this is a point that needs to be made over and over again. Talking about TC, talking about phase diagram is more meaningful than talking about TC.
The digital structures are definitely a lot dirtier.
There's no question about it.
That don't show hopping
transport. They're all, so far, they're all insulating, all of them, so far.
All samples, at least many of them, roughly.
So far, they're all insulating, the digital structures.
You mentioned this magnets in the semiconductor. I just wonder whether there's any work in magnetic purity in a superconductor, in particular SOE superconductor.
So what you want is that puts a bunch of magnetic impurities in an SOE superconductor.
Yeah, so hopefully, I don't know, so the issue is that whether some kind of optical KY interaction between those paired electrons can induce some kind of spin coupling, which.
But what number? That's what's going
to make a room temperature ferromagnet.
Yes. No, but we are in. This is exotic. We don't care about the temperature. This is exotic, okay?
This is maybe one way.
This guy is too practical. I have to keep on reminding him. It's exotic, okay?
That's maybe one way to guess. But engineer or quantum
speed. No, it's a very good point. But Shogun, can you go slowly? If you have a superconductor, then you put magnetic impurities. It's obvious that you have RKKY interaction.
But
there's really no Fermi surface, right?
That's my question.
There is a gap there.
Just
no, let's say it doesn't. I mean, let's throw all these trivial things out. We're asking a question of principle. Let's say you can put magnetic impurities at any concentration you want in a good SOF superconductor. Whether it can be done or not is the next question. If we find after doing all this there is nothing interesting, even we will not ask the experimenters to do it. Yeah, so.
What's the motivation?
Well, that's one way to engineer a quantum spin system.
What's more quantum about it than any other spin system?
There's in a sense, let me see, it's so hopefully interaction between spin is more complicated than the Euro exchange.
You want it more complicated.
All right, we want more comments, okay? This is a good comment. And this is certainly something to think about. Greg, you want to add anything?
Yeah, actually I have maybe 5 minutes.
Please, absolutely. Let me tell you.